You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, after a year of record-breaking coastal floods, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says more places will be hit more often. Jen White looks at what the science says about ice melt and sea level rise today at 6 on 1A+. Now, anybody who's raised a kid will tell you parenting can be hard work. But we don't always think of nurturing our children as the same kind of hard work as going to a job. Raising our own kids doesn't earn us a paycheck, and it doesn't always carry the same value in society as a job outside the home. Our next guest says mothering in particular is undervalued, and she writes, quote, "We must start by acknowledging mothering as highly skilled work that deserves respect and compensation." You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like parenting, mothering in particular, is undervalued in some way? Have you ever added up the value of all the different tasks you do while raising a kid and wondering, what does a job like that pay if we put a dollar value on it? Did the pandemic change the experience of parenting, especially for the moms out there? Was it more isolated? Did you feel like on your own even more maybe than you had been before? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Angela Garbez is a writer and author of the book Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change. Angela, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
It's kind of this weird paradox. I think we put a lot of cultural and symbolic value on mothering, but not a lot of, I guess, practical and financial value on it. Make the case for rethinking and changing that a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, cultural and symbolic value doesn't really get you a lot in the real world. I would say, here's the case. We're both adults, and we didn't make it here on our own. Somebody gave birth to you. Somebody took care of you through the helplessness of infancy. Someone made sure you got to school on time. Someone helped you read. Someone taught you how to bathe yourself, clean yourself, and did that for you before you could do it. And that care that we give babies, even though they've done nothing to earn it, really, except be born, why do we not value that as people get older, right? No one makes it through life without being cared for and mothered. And that doesn't always just happen from a parent. It happens from a beloved teacher. It happens from a grandmother, an auntie, chosen family, mentors. And really, this basic care work, mothering is really tending to our physical and basic emotional needs. It's the work that makes all other work possible. If you didn't know how to feed and dress yourself, if you didn't have a roof over your head, you wouldn't be able to go out and do other things in the world, you know, professional work. But I really believe that caring for ourselves and caring for our people is the only real work humans have to do. And it's about time we start talking about it as essential labor.
Yeah, you put it in the context of the, you know, American economy, the global economy. We think of productivity as, you know, the jobs we're making stuff, selling it to each other and that sort of thing. You use the phrase, and others do, reproductive labor. Without the labor that goes into raising kids, none of that other stuff can happen. It's kind of like there's this big, you know, under the iceberg, to use the cliche, that we're not seeing.
Yeah, no, that's a great way of putting it. One thing that American capitalism has never fully dealt with is that we rely just as much on domestic labor, which happens in the home and is expected for free from mothers or for very low wages for professional domestic and care workers. The economy doesn't run without it. And we really saw this in the pandemic when child care centers closed, when nannies and babysitters couldn't come to our homes. We were all lost. And people found that it was very difficult to do professional work and to do domestic work and care at the same time. It's more than one person can do.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Deb is with us in Waukesha. Deb, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Deb?
This is such an important topic. I will share that I am 63 years old, and it has just dawned on me in the last couple years that I should have been receiving a paycheck from the family budget for being a stay-at-home mom. And I believe that without that, we lose our sense of of a sense of power and a sense of value that is needed, especially at that time when we're staying home watching the children. And if we had to go out and do those services, as you're hearing from the other callers, it would be so expensive and so valuable. And I think every stay-at-home mom needs to be paid for what they're doing.
Deb, thanks for the call. Angela, what do you think?
I think everyone should listen to Deb. Right on, Deb. I think that we should reframe it. So, yeah, you can say, you know, in America we say, oh, she's just a stay-at-home mom, or I'm just a stay-at-home mom. But how about I'm the CEO of my household? I'm the chief executive officer of household logistics, right? I am the household manager. We really need to reframe this. Like, she's exactly right. Like, these skills of, you know, oh, there's so much creativity involved. There's so much thinking on the fly. There's so much multitasking and so much management. You know, out in the professional world, we pay higher wages for that. But in the home, because it's private and because we like to think of it as quote unquote women's work, we think it should be done for free. But no, this is something that I thought about a lot in the pandemic, which was a lot of the seed for this book, which is that at the very beginning of the pandemic, when I was home 24/7 with my children for 4 months straight, and I knew that was the most important job I could be doing, keeping them safe and keeping my community safe and healthy. And I was hearing about how, you know, we were talking about essential laborers, healthcare workers, the doctors and nurses who were treating us, you know, sanitation workers, teachers, and all of those people are yes, essential to our society. And then I thought, what about us? What about parents? What about mothers? Because I'm working all the time and it feels pretty darn essential.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking Angela Garbez, author of the new book, Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change. Angela, you mentioned workers who do a lot of the jobs that we associate kind of in the mothering job description, house cleaners, childcare providers, and others often being paid very low. Often, you write, these jobs being done by women of color in particular. Can you talk about your hopes for them as well?
Sure. So I think, you know, as long as we're reckoning with some of the things in America that we've never fully reckoned with, the reason why we are comfortable paying women of color, and the majority of people doing this work are Black and brown women, and the majority of them are mothers themselves. So the reason why I believe we are willing to pay them less or expect this work for very, like, you know, poor wages is because of the history of slavery in America. The home has always been a site of work for Black women in this country. And when, you know, feminism in the 1960s told everyone, Betty Friedan said, you know, find meaning outside of the home, that's great. But we never got rid of domestic labor. And so we started hiring Black and brown women to do those wages. And domestic workers are 3 times as likely to live in poverty as any other worker in America. And that's really shameful. If we are entrusting people with what we say is the most valuable thing, the most important thing in our lives, those are our children, and we can't pay them a living wage, what does that say about us as a society? You know, what does that say about us as individuals? The median wage for any worker in America is close to $20 an hour, which is already barely enough to make it. But when we look at domestic workers, that drops to a median wage of $12 an hour. And the lowest median wage in the country is for nannies. That's $11.60 an hour. So I think it's really a myth to say that this work is unskilled labor. I think that's the way we justify paying low wages. But really, all work is real work. If you've ever taken care of a child for longer than 15 minutes, you know it is not unskilled labor. You have to know how to soothe that child, how to calm them. And it's so fundamental to our existence as a society, and it's a shame that we don't value it the way that we should.
We're talking with author Angela Garbez about her latest book. It's called Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think motherhood, not as an idea, but as a set of tasks, as a work, a job in a way, gets enough recognition? Do you have an experience you'd like to share with us? Do you have a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Angela Garbez. She's with us today sharing her latest book, Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change. And you can join in at 800-642-1234, maybe with your own experiences as a mom, with your questions for our guest, 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Carol is with us in Hillsboro. Carol, hello.
Hi. I had the privilege of being a stay-at-home mom. We had five kids, and I had two that were in grade school, and then a baby, a two-year-old, and a four-year-old. And my husband came home from work one day and said, "What do you do around here all day?" You know, I guess the house was a mess and dishes weren't done. So I started writing down what I did every day, and then I checked it off like I actually had a list, and I threw a couple things in there that I didn't do. And then I did that for 2 weeks, and then I gave him a bill for being an accountant, a laundry person, a chef, a housekeeper, a daycare and nanny, and a personal shopper, and he couldn't afford me.
Carol, thank you for sharing that that experiment with us. Angela, what do you think?
More people should do what Carol does. And there's actually, I applaud Carol for keeping that kind of record and information, because it's a way of showing people, you know, these things that we take for granted, we can't. There's so much that goes into it. And I invite, actually, listeners, I did this, and I write about it in the book. A journalist named Amy Westervelt created something called the Invisible Labor Calculator. And if you Google this, you'll find it. And she used Bureau of Labor Statistics and data to assign value to different household jobs, you know, whether that's gardening, shopping, as Carol had mentioned, you know, nannying, childcare, and tending to the emotional and psychological needs of your family members. So you can put in what, you know, the amount of time you think you spend doing that every week, and it will calculate for you, based again on U.S. government data, what your salary would be. And so I did this at the beginning of the pandemic, and I was shocked to find out that, I was so shocked actually that I did it twice because I didn't believe it the first time, but the Invisible Labor Calculator told me that I would be making over $300,000 a year in my job as a stay-at-home mother and caregiver. And that would be the highest paying job I've ever had by three times, more than three times. And that's something that, you know, that's what Carol did years ago. And I think that it's really important for people to see that, I invite people to try that and to start to begin to really think about how valuable their work is within the home. Oxfam actually did a study a couple of years ago and said that in the U.S. alone, if women were paid minimum wage for all the unpaid labor they did in the home, it would be worth $1.9 trillion.
Thanks.
And that is money that is not counted in our economy, and it should be.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Courtney joins us now in Madison. Courtney, hi.
Hi. Mine is a little off the topic of in-home care because my child's in daycare, and my husband and I are just completely appalled at the amount that we pay but how little the care workers make in daycare. And I was curious if your speaker has any thoughts on the role of government in helping to support that. And particularly, we've been discussing in our family how in Canada, they're working really hard to get $20 a day daycares, and that's supported by the government. And in BC, $10 a day daycare. So I was just curious if your speaker had any thoughts on that.
Courtney, thanks. Angela, go ahead.
Oh, Courtney, I do. I think that we all do. Parents are all overwhelmed, right? And we're stretched. And we do things to make community all the time. We take care of each other's kids. We do play dates, right? But we are not, there's a structural failing here. You know, we tend to feel like because things are happening in the home, they feel like individual failures that we have, or we feel like, how do we solve the problem of like giving our beloved caregivers more money, right? And this is really where the government needs to step in, right? We have privatized all human rights in the United States. Like, you're not guaranteed health care or housing, early childhood education, or an education, you know,
as you get older. Other countries have figured this out, which is not to say that other countries are perfect, but other countries believe in valuing people and investing in people. And I don't know about you, Courtney, but I personally voted in this administration, the Biden administration, because they ran on things like care infrastructure, paid family leave. They also ran on codifying Roe v. Wade. And they've really bargained away those things. In Build Back Better, we, the Democrats, let those things slide. You know, we recently passed a new package in all provisions to supply, to fund care in the home and to fund early childhood education centers were, you know, sort of let go as collateral damage to make a deal. And the people who represent us need to know that that is a failing on their part and they are not making good on promises. And at this point, we need investment from the government. Working people, working families are doing everything they can to make ends meet out here, and this is not working for us. And yes, our electeds need to hear from us, and the government needs to do more.
Thanks for the call, Courtney. Leah joins us next in Lafarge. Leah, hello.
Hi. I was going to say that when I was out of work during the pandemic, I decided to fully embrace being a stay-at-home mom and to see what that was like. And I did a lot of the same things that I did when I was working, but I had more time to do it. And what I found was that I still wasn't able to stay on top of all the mess with all the people, with it all being just one person's job. And so I felt, you know, my husband was still working, so he's paying all the bills. So I didn't necessarily feel like I needed to be paid. I just felt like I needed to be very much appreciated because it is like that invisibleness of the work. Because if you're not having to pay all the bills, like that's a load off of your back. But it's just in that those chores can be, you know, done and forgotten, and then you know you got to do them all over again. So I'm kind of making a case as the mom or the dad, or even better as a team, being the household manager to enlist labor from everyone, and that's better for moms, it's better for dads, and it's better for the kids to be participating.
Leah, thanks a lot for that call. Angela, what do you think?
I think Leah is right on, for sure. You know, I was in a similar situation where I put my work on hold because it's my husband's job who gives us a paycheck, who gives us regular health insurance. And as a freelance writer, I don't get those things. And part of why I wrote this book was born out of all of the feelings I had in being a caretaker, missing my professional work, and really feeling like acknowledgement would go a long way. I mean, I do think that we deserve wages for the work that we do, but any kind of acknowledgement and appreciation does go a long way. And one of the things that I did is I talked to my children, you know, about this. I said to them, you know, when I'm feeding them three meals a day and snacks and seemingly every hour, I would say to them, you know, I do this because I love you. And I will never stop doing this. But this takes work for me to cook dinner, for me to wash your clothes, for me to take care of you. That takes energy and time. And we really need to name this stuff as work. And also to pick up on something Leah was saying, it's too much for one person to do. And that's another thing about modern American life, is that we live in nuclear families. We really prize, you know, one mom, one dad, and 2.2 kids. And it's just not meant how we were meant to raise kids. Throughout the entire world, for centuries, we raised children communally. So, you know, if it feels like too much to cook, 21 meals a week for your family and to do 7 loads of laundry, it's because it is too much, because we do need help from our partners, from other household members, from even our children, but also we need help from friends. We need help from an extended network. We need chosen family. And that's another thing I saw in the pandemic, people forming pods, people taking care of each other's children, having family dinners and kind of throwing their lots in together. I think that's a very human urge to want to be taken care of and to take care of others. And it's healthier and it's emotionally very wonderful. And I think we could all lean into that a little bit more as the pandemic, it's not over, but as it sort of recedes more into the rear view, I don't want us to give up that interdependence and that realization that Taking care of ourselves is work, and that we cannot do it entirely alone.
Just very briefly, Angela, we've just got a minute left. We haven't even touched really the second half of your book. You were hoping to make mothering a joyful experience and raise happy kids. Can you leave us with just a minute thought on that?
Yes. I mean, it's easy to focus on all the things that are hard, but I wrote this book in part as a celebration of caregiving because it is so fundamental. And when you don't have to worry about where the next paycheck coming from, when you are able to do those things in community and really be present with your children and be present with yourself, it can be some of the most meaningful, joyful work. You know, when I get down, I don't really like imaginative play, but when I get down on all fours and meow like a cat with my three-year-old, I mean, it brings something to my life that I can't quantify. And it is also realizing that I can teach my children joy. I can show them that they are valuable just as they are. They don't need to go have a job to contribute something to the world. And that's really what mothering is day in and day out. It's insisting on our value and our worth, and that will serve children for years to come.
Angela, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob, and thank you to all your wonderful callers.
That's Angela Garbez, writer and author of the book Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll review today's primary election results and then set the stage for the next 3 months and the run-up to the statewide general elections. And, of course, you can call in with your reactions to whatever comes out of today. And it's a Central Time favorite with an up-close look at the brown bears at an Alaskan national park featured in one of the best live webcams in nature. A park ranger is going to join the show and answer our questions. Well, my questions anyway. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, federal waivers allowed schools provide universal free school meals to K-12 students, but those waivers were not extended for the upcoming school year. An expert in the field and a reporter tracking the story share the latest. First, Democrats in the U.S. Senate passed a bill over the weekend that makes some big investments to fight climate change, with some climate advocates saying it would be the most significant action the U.S. has taken on global warming to date. The Inflation Reduction Act includes billions of dollars in investments for the renewable energy industry. It also has tax credits to encourage Americans to do things like buy electric cars and make their homes more energy efficient. The House of Representatives is set to vote on the bill later this week. It's expected to pass there. If it does, some estimates say it would put the U.S. on track to lower greenhouse gas emissions by 40% compared to 2005 levels by the end of this decade. That's close to a target scientists say the world needs to hit to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Are you happy to see this bill moving forward? What do you think about the idea of using incentives to get more renewable energy usage out there? How about the fact that it doesn't include a carbon tax? Do you have a question about what it does and doesn't do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lisa Friedman is a reporter for the New York Times who covers climate and environmental policy. Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to give a listen to Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Here he is in a press conference after this act passed the Senate after a long session on Sunday.
The Senate has now passed the most significant bill to fight the climate crisis ever. And it's going to make a difference to my grandkids. The world will be a better place for my grandchildren because of what we did today.
Before we dig into some of the specifics here, Lisa, how big a deal are climate experts saying this thing would be if it in fact gets passed by the House, signed by the president?
A very big deal. And that's both in terms of the emissions cuts and in terms of, you know, finally seeing action from Congress after decades of folks who care deeply about the threat of climate change trying to push lawmakers to take major action.
Yeah, in a recent piece on the history of efforts to pass something on climate change, you mentioned an anecdote about a president getting a report from one of his aides. The president was Richard Nixon. The year was 1969. This is a long time coming. What have been some of the biggest roadblocks to passing something on this scale?
I would say probably first and foremost, a strong, well-financed, concerted effort by the fossil fuel industry to both inject doubt as to the science of climate change and to the severity of climate change. Past that, you've had real deep divisions among lawmakers and the public about the best way to go about addressing climate change.
Now let's look into the specifics. I think a lot of the attention was on kind of the political flurry of activity through the weekend. Let's look at what ended up in here. First of all, what kind of things are there when it comes to alternative energy and the batteries needed to store and use that energy?
Sure. Well, just first to put this bill in context, the president has said he wants to cut U.S. emissions 50 to 52% below 2005 levels, that's the peak of U.S. emissions, by the end of this decade. This bill helps get the U.S. within striking distance of that goal, about 40% below 2005 levels. To get there, this bill doesn't tax industries, it doesn't, penalize polluting industries. It provides incentives in the form of tax breaks, predominantly about $370 billion worth over 10 years for everything from wind and solar development to heat pumps to advanced nuclear and clean hydrogen technology to store carbon from factories and power plants and store carbon dioxide emissions, and also to purchase electric vehicles and move away from gas-powered vehicles.
We are talking about the climate change elements of the act just passed by the Senate over the weekend, waiting for a vote in the House later this week. Lisa Friedman is with us from the New York Times, reporter on climate and environmental policy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. With your thoughts on this bill that passed the Senate, your questions about what's in it, maybe what it means to you, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. So some of this is big picture, promoting industry, promoting solar panels and things like that. Some of this goes straight to consumers, as I understand it, Lisa. What kind of things would, say, homeowners or car drivers or others be able to look to in this to make decisions in the future?
Yeah, let's start with automobiles, because the tax incentive in here, $7,500 for a new electric vehicle, $4,000 for a used electric vehicle. That is a rebate that, as I understand the legislation, would be one would see at the dealership. You wouldn't have to sort of file your taxes and get that money back. Beyond that, for homeowners, there's a home improvement credit for energy efficiency. It would allow households to deduct from their taxes somewhere around 30% of the cost of upgrades, like heat pumps or insulation. There's also a provision to allow households to receive tax breaks if they are installing solar or battery storage systems. So there's a lot of real practical measures in here to entice both businesses and consumers to change the way they power their lives from fossil fuels to cleaner energy sources.
Now, a key figure here was Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. He was a key player in negotiating this thing, and he got some fossil fuel related and drilling related provisions in the bill. What kind of trade-offs did the people who wanted these climate change provisions have to make here?
Yeah, there are concessions in this bill. Senator Manchin has been very clear about his strong support for a gas pipeline in his state, the Mountain Valley Pipeline. He secured a promise from Democratic leaders that a separate bill later this year will include provisions to complete that project, which has been held up with permits and in the courts. In this reconciliation package itself, which couldn't contain the pipeline provision because of the unique way that it's written, there were provisions to ensure that there will be continued oil and gas drilling leasing in the Gulf of Mexico, in Alaska's Cook Inlet, and on federal lands as well. This will essentially make it impossible for President Biden to fulfill a promise he made during the campaign to end new oil and gas leasing on federal lands and waters. It's also something that is really of deep concern to a number of environmental advocates who want to end new fossil fuel development.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I got to tell you, I could not be more excited about what this is going to mean to me in my life and my life, but also for our country and for the state of Wisconsin. This investment in the electrical industry, and I work in the electrical industry, is going to be a good thing, not only for our environment, but it'll be good for innovation. And I've spoken with auto manufacturers at car shows and dealerships themselves, and they're already psyched about getting the infrastructure into people's homes and, you know, getting people into these electric cars. You can live in Minneapolis or Chicago, and you have a 300-mile range. You could be a commuter and use one of these vehicles for your running your errands, bringing your kids to school. It's very practical, and it's going to help our environment. I couldn't be more excited.
Jeff, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. I think, Lisa, the hope, and I think this is part of the bill, too, is that it goes beyond the commuters and that range. Part of the effort, and this is there's been some stuff from the Biden administration already, trying to make sure that there's charging and better range for electric vehicles as well.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, you asked me earlier about sort of the history of this, and I would say that, you know, for a long time, those who wanted to address climate change were focused on a tax on carbon polluting industries. Increasingly, folks who are working on this issue, and you see from the Biden administration, they decided that the winning strategy was going to be carrots, not sticks, incentives to change the economy, to incentivize, as the caller mentioned, innovation. And that seems to have been the key to this working politically, and is certainly leading to a lot of, you know, excitement in clean energy sectors.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. We're talking to Lisa Friedman, reporter for the New York Times, who covers climate and environmental policy, with us today to talk about the climate provisions in the Democrats' Inflation Reduction Act, how meaningful they might be for U.S. efforts to fight climate change. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of what you've heard and seen about this bill so far? Too far? Not enough? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about legislation from Democrats passed the U.S. Senate, going to the House later this week, part of it making big investments aimed at combating climate change. Lisa Friedman from the New York Times Climate Desk stays with us, and there's still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Dan is with us in Eau Claire. Dan, hi.
Yeah, hi. Just wondering if anybody's looked up how cold will it get after we change to all electric vehicles?
How cold, you said, Dan? Dan, thanks for the call. Lisa, looking at the temperature impact, as I understand it, these changes at this point are slowing down the rate of temperature increase, annual temperature increase, more than cooling it back down. Am I right at this point?
That's right. I mean, a lot of global warming is baked into the atmosphere from decades already of emissions. Slowing down the rate of emissions will in turn slow global warming. The countries under the Paris Agreement and later last year in Glasgow agreed to try to keep global temperature rise from exceeding 1.5 degrees from pre-industrial levels. We're now at about 1.1. So that is the goal of you know, keeping global temperatures below 1.5, which scientists say is a threshold beyond which the consequences of climate change, floods and wildfires and droughts, et cetera, become much more severe.
Thanks for the call. Mary joins us next in West Allis. Mary, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call. Thank you so much for accepting my call. A year ago, I actually called in. We relocated to Lisbon, Portugal. And we hadn't been back for a year. We're back in West Allis now. But I have to tell you how life-changing it is having the European style of travel. We live in the city center. It is our life to use the metro, the buses, the streetcars. Everything is walkable. We live with no car, and probably other than one time have even wanted to have a car. And, you know, as far as like climate change and all of that, you know, getting in an electric car to do your errands when you have such a sprawled out kind of community might be something that electric cars can help. But I think it is really a mindset change.
Mary, welcome back. I do remember your call, I think, when you went to Lisbon. Thanks for checking back in with us. Mary's saying, maybe less of a car-centric economy in the first place. Lisa, I don't think that is really part of this bill.
It's not, but I mean, certainly, you know, and yes, of course, you know, urban planning and how we arrange our communities is a much larger conversation and policy issue. But, public transportation is better for climate change than even electric cars. And where that's possible, I salute you for being able to do it.
Mary, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Sharon joins us now in Minocqua. Sharon, hi.
Hi. Thank you very much for letting me, ask my question, but I also have a comment, too. First off, this is wonderful news, and I am I'm actually surprised that this is getting passed in the Senate. Fingers crossed it'll pass in the House. But I do have, if we are to transition off of fossil fuels, it will have ripple effects and impacts on other sectors and other industries. So much of the byproducts of fossil fuels go into things like plastic production, which is essential in many industries like healthcare. And we also produce so much synthetic nitrogen, byproduct of fossil fuels. In addition, coal is still an essential component of steel making. So how do we address those impacts by transitioning off of fossil fuels? Does this act include research and funding for creating those alternatives?
Interesting. Sharon, thanks for the call. Lisa, I think we think of the energy use of these fossil fuels. Sharon pointing out there's a lot of other stuff they do too. Is this on the radar?
It's certainly on the radar. There is a lot of money in this bill for advanced manufacturing, for research. And I know that the Department of Energy has been doing a lot of research into alternate uses for fossil fuels. I think, you know, one of the other things that that's important to note about this bill is that, as the caller mentioned, you know, there's also a concern about the communities that have been dependent on fossil fuels and that have provided the energy that has powered our country for decades. There is quite a lot of money in this bill, both from, that Senator Manchin and others work to get to help, for example, site renewable energy manufacturing factories in former coal fields. Those kinds of things to make sure that fossil fuel communities are not left behind.
Thanks for that call, Sharon. Cindy joins us next in Belleville. Cindy, hello.
Hello. I'm so glad to talk with you today. As we speak, the solar installers are here at my house installing the panels.
Oh, wow.
So our system does not yet include a battery system. And I'm wondering about the battery incentives that will be coming in this act and when they will be kicking in. And so how long we should wait before planning on adding batteries to our solar system.
Oh, interesting, Cindy. Do we have that kind of timeline on this yet, Lisa?
I have to admit, I don't know the answer to that question on the timeline. There is funding in the bill for battery development, and especially for battery manufacturing, obviously in the U.S., which has been a huge priority of of lawmakers. I don't know the timing question for you offhand. I apologize.
Well, Cindy, thanks for the call. And I'm sure when this passes the House and gets signed, they'll start hammering some of that out. Now, we got an email from Matt in Madison who writes, what good is any of this progress on climate change when Republicans will just nullify it when they take power? Now, there's been a lot of back and forth with executive actions on climate change between Republican and Democratic presidents. Does this nail things down a little more, passing it, assuming it passes the House, passing it through Congress?
It's a great question because, you know, I'm sure that the past many years has been confusing for a lot of people as we've been covering this boomerang of, you know, Obama administration doing X and Trump administration pushing back and doing Y. This, if it indeed passes the House and is signed by the president, will be legislation that, unlike regulation, cannot be easily undone by a president. It would require another act of Congress to undo these measures. And you know, once Congress gives something, look at the ACA. It is hard to undo things, even when there is opposition. So, you know, the bottom line is, if this indeed passes and is signed by the president, it will have a staying power that regulatory efforts have not had and would not have.
One more piece of the puzzle here that came up, and at least some of your coverage on this, Lisa, is what this means for the international climate change scene. You wrote that, in effect, a lot of countries are saying, why are we going to go through the expense of doing this if the United States isn't going to do it? How big an impact could this have on that kind of thinking?
You know, time will have to tell, but you know, it seems very significant. I mean, what, you know, I've been to now 10 UN climate conferences. I've covered Glasgow and the Paris Agreement. And there's been one constant, which is when the U.S. doesn't act, other countries hide behind the United States. And, you know, the biggest emitter now, China, other big emitters, India, Brazil, the excuse of the U.S. not acting won't be there anymore. There will still be questions for the United States. Getting to 40% is not 50. By many arguments, the United States, the biggest historic emitter in the world, should be doing even far more than that. There is money that the U.S. and other developed countries have promised to help the poorest countries move away from fossil fuels themselves. A lot of that has not materialized. So there are still a number of issues in the international arena, but certainly the U.S. now, by all accounts, and the folks that I've spoken to, has a much stronger argument to make to other big emitters in trying to get them to step up their ambition.
Lisa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Lisa Friedman, reporter for the New York Times who covers climate and environmental policy. She was with us today to talk about the climate change provisions in the Democratic bill known as the Inflation Reduction Act. It passed the U.S. Senate over the weekend after a marathon session. The U.S. House is scheduled to vote on it later this week, where it's, at least for now, expected to pass. Coming up after the news, as kids get ready to go back to school, some school nutrition programs are going to expire or change. We'll find out what's in the works with a new report from Wisconsin Watch. Then a researcher joins us with a look at the impact of universal free lunch programs on learning and on discipline in schools. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.